We're in our dialogue discussion on working with 1,000 possibilities, work, vocation, and spirituality at the end of the millennium. And I hope this is clear and everyone can hear. I'm going to open with a couple of quotes, things to think about as we sort of enter our discussion. And secondly, I'm going to talk a little bit about the process. And then I have a few things to share, and then I want to open it up for dialogue and discussion. I'm reading from a book recently published by Matthew Fox, and my disclaimer is that there's some great things that Father Fox has produced, and some not so great things. His book, certainly on compassion and spirituality, were things that touched me during my seminary training. And recently, he's decided to take a look at the reinvention of work. And so these readings are from The Reinvention of Work, New Vision of Livelihood for Our Time. And as an executive consultant, I have been thinking about that as I've worked with people along the way. There are a couple of things in here, and this is a direct quote from Father Fox. There is so much work to be done in our time, but it is primarily work on ourselves, work on our better selves, in the Latin translation of the via positiva, and work on our shadow selves, the via negativa. There's so much work to be done. Secondly, our sister Hildegard had something to say also about work. Be not lax in celebrating. Be not lazy in the festive service of God. Be ablaze with enthusiasm. Let us be an alive, burning offering before the altar of God. Something to think about as we engage in our discussion this morning. The process that I want to invite you to participate in is one of a dialogue. And I'm making a difference between a dialogue and a discussion. A discussion tends to want to break things apart. Dialogue really focuses on sort of what does this mean for us, and maybe out of our talking with one another, we may create fresh meaning or return to old meanings and see them in new ways. So I want to invite you to sort of enter in with me into a container. And in that container, we want to inquire, we want to meditate, and that can be active meditation as well as times for silence, and give ourselves an opportunity to really sort of kind of come at this from where we are. I will sort of get it going by making some comments and sharing with you an evolving model I have for sort of ways in which one might want to approach this question of work and vocation. And I'm making a distinction between the two. Work are things like jobs and projects and painting and that sort of thing. Vocation is what really getting a sense of what is our calling. And we act out our calling not only within the context of what we traditionally call work, but it's just being a person on the planet here. And so I want to walk you through that model, and then let's sort of engage in some discussion about what touches you or what triggers your imagination. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. Beginning to look at this notion of work and vocation is frankly being involved in all of the downsizing, mergers, acquisitions, outsizing, right-sizing activities of being in corporate America. And it really began to get to me when we began to downsize older workers at Green Giant in Minneapolis, when I had to look at some people in the face and say, your career with Green Giant is over after 35 years, and oh, by the way, we're not going to pay the bridge, which is 3 more years until you retire. I should state that we've changed that policy because the ethics around it was just so disturbing. But where I really began to take a look at it is that so many people have put their eggs in this particular basket over here. So what they did is, what in many ways is what I call drank the Kool-Aid. They signed up, and they signed up 35 years ago, and their whole life was connected to this. You take this away, and there was nothing. I had a number of executives absolutely break down and cry and say, where am I going to go? One example was a person who was told on Monday that her job was eliminated. And for the next 3 weeks, got on the bus every morning, dressed as if she was going to work. And it wasn't until her phone was turned off that her husband discovered that her job had gone away. She had dressed up, gone to work, had gotten on the bus, and because she could not deal with the reality that that had gone away. There was nothing, in many ways, for her to fall back on. And so as I began to work with people in this, what I call a significant spiritual crisis, because of a change or a dislocation, I began to wonder, why is the loss of a job such a significant event for people that takes them into sort of the dark night of the soul in some ways? Why is that? And a lot of people would say, I have nothing to fall back on. Nothing. So as I started to think about it, I said, you know, I think there's a difference between vocation and work. And the difference is that vocation has to do with what we're called to do. Your calling never goes away. It can never be debased by whether or not you're working on this project or that project. It becomes, work is almost sort of temporal in some kind of way. But if you don't have a sense of what your vocation is, then when this goes away, it's empty. But I also wonder, there's something that sort of ought to be the link between vocation and work. And I believe that that's faith. And this is sort of what I'm going to challenge us to have discussion about. And that it takes a faith rooted in the gospel, and this sort of comes out of my sort of Lutheran understanding. And that when you have that and you have done some thinking about vocation, this can begin to influence the projects of your life. And the projects of your life are things that I call your work. So I was a camp counselor at one point. I've been an executive. I don't know what I'm going to be 2 years, 3 years from now. But I do know what my vocation is and what my calling is. I have a sense of that. When people go through downsizing and they lose their jobs, particularly people who have, what I said, drank the Kool-Aid, been in the same company for so long, they realize that the differentiation between the work and who they are so sort of begins to show up. And the joy that people experience when they really begin to ask the question, what is my vocation? What is my purpose? But oftentimes that's driven by nothing being available here or not being able to jump into some other type of work which is the same. And when that crisis happens, people often have to come back here and reclaim their faith and often go here in order to make the kinds of shifts because they're just not available. Somewhere between vocation and work is what I call vineyards of possibility. It's amazing. I ran into someone from Digital Equipment, which is a company I worked at in the mid-80s. They went from 130,000 employees down now to less than 30,000. Wow. Over about an 8-year period. With enormous gnashing of teeth. And I ran into an engineer, and I was at the baggage claim, and he came up and he says, you know, did I work with you at Digital, blah, 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 blah. I said, yeah, you did. I said, what are you doing now? He says, I'm teaching. I always wanted to be a teacher. And when I couldn't get another job as a systems engineer, I said, well, I've always wanted to be a teacher. That would be make me happy. I feel called to be a teacher. And this person looked 20 years younger. Some people have gone into carpentry. One person I know was a plant manager at Green Giant, now makes futons. He says, Anthony, I know you think this is kind of woo-woo, but I sort of like it. I feel some calling to do this, and I decided that we could make futons better. So he makes futons. This is a guy that made $250,000 a year as a plant manager. So somewhere between vocation and work is what I call this vineyards of possibility. Again, I think it has to be driven out of your faith. The other piece I'll say is that talents and imagination are also sort of required in order to pull this thing off. And the question is, what are your talents? And I would say plural, because I think one of the wonderful things that we are gifted with is enormous talent. And part of life's journey is to begin to discover what those are, because sometimes they don't show up until various points in our life, often driven by reality. And I think that there are two realities that I just want to comment on, and then I want to leave it for question discussion. One is, I call it the drinking the Kool-Aid reality. And that really has to do with merchant mentalities. We live in a world that has a merchant mentality. Everything is for sale, including God in some cases. That we have a culture of capitalism, and one of the books I want to suggest that you read is The Seven Cultures of Capitalism, because capitalism acts itself out in different parts of the world, which is part of the issue we're having about trade. And sort of where does faith show up? Sort of capitalism in Japan looks very different than capitalism here and in Mexico and in parts of South America. And it's very important for you to understand that that's what makes the economy variable. And then something that we will call systems dynamics. And the way that systems work in terms of understanding there's something called transitions, and if you don't understand that you need to transition at a certain time, you end up in something we call, in business, the Willenda death spiral, because things change. And so you have to begin to understand how systems operate. I often think that the church has a challenge here, because the church needs to begin to understand that they have to speak to the culture, not be of the culture, but you've got to understand what culture you're talking to. You're not talking to the culture of the 1950s, but you're talking to the culture of the 1990s. And I think the church really has a real challenge around that. I think it's fresh and exciting, and doesn't have to be a dirge. On the reality piece, I think that part of staying focused in this drinking the Kool-Aid time of life is a focus on things like our baptism, the Eucharist. Some people want to say marriage here, because some Catholics would say marriage, but I think it's also about relationships, the quality of the kinds of relationships we have. A lot of people have talked to me because their relationships are bounded by their work. And when work goes away, what happened to the relationships? A person shared a very sad story with me. A person had a heart attack, died in his office. By Monday, the office had been cleaned out, and another person had been assigned, as though the person had never existed, and the person had worked there for 37 years. And at the funeral, no one from the company came to the funeral. No one. And so I think there's room for us to be thinking about what are those important relationships that we need to have in life as we live out our vocation, and we don't become seduced by the muse of work and financial. The other piece is the ordination, and this is really the priesthood of all believers. So what does it mean to be called to the priesthood? Wouldn't it be interesting to spend some time in an adult dynamic about, so how, what's your plan for priest being a priest this year? What you gonna do? I was with some lay people in San Antonio, Texas, and they came back. We were talking about the future of the church, and they started their dialogue with, Jesus said do. And we want to borrow from the Nike people, but Jesus said do. So what would that look like for you? The next piece is this piece I talked about in our session earlier about confirmation. What would it mean to go through confirmation on an annual basis? And if we were to do that as a community, what points of the pieces around the catechism would really speak to our time? Healing. There's a tremendous opportunity for not only personal healing, but healing in our community. And you can name those things. And then last, love's confessions. I think our confessions are an expression of love. They are a gift of love. And how do we make that active in the society? Now, what I have done for you is I've produced a mind map of thinking. And I want to open it now to dialogue and discussion. And what has it sort of, and I'm going to sit down now. What has it juiced for you? And maybe you might want to add to the mind map. Thanks. Yes?
Listen, before you go on this too much, can we just back up the kind of basis of what's happening? the cultural capitals that we live in. And, you know, somebody downsizes from 130,000 employees to 30. You know, somebody made some money in there.
Yes.
And there were 100,000 people who lost their jobs.
Yes.
And so, you know, we want to focus and get people out of their work mentality into a vocation, but there's something that's not so bad about working for a company for 35 years. And there's something that's not so bad. I mean, that's not just a paycheck. That's community. That's a feeling of self-worth. That's family stability. There's things that's the company's responsibility in providing jobs in the community and offering stability in the community. I mean, there's some bad things. I mean, if we want to react to what's going on, I think we also have to realize that some of the merging and acquisitions and the lack of organizational loyalty that's going on in our country right now, there's a real bad side to that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about how to react to it, but I think I certainly have a feeling that this is a little destructive. The whole thing that you're trying to react to,
mm-hmm.
the whole thing is destructive. It's not so bad to be tied up, because there's some good things that happen when companies buy into it.
Exactly. But most companies, at least the large ones, aren't loyal to communities or to individuals. And so the contract, we call it a psychological contract. It's been broken. Oh, definitely.
I think Green Giant was.
Oh, yeah.
I think your automobile makers are in Detroit.
Yep.
I think that there was a lot of community responsibility. We have paper companies up in northern Minnesota.
That's right.
We have Landon in Grand Rapids. Very loyal to the community. And you've got some that owned outside the area that aren't.
But the moment Green Giant was bought by the British, they closed all, well, not the moment, but they basically have closed all of the plants in the small towns, both in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And these small towns sustain families and sustain college students. I met generations of people who got through college simply because they canned peas in Le Sueur. And so that whole tradition gets cut off. And what happens, however, is you can get so caught up and seduced into this idyllic that you've got this relationship. And what's happened in the 80s and the 90s is that relationship has been cut off, which says, well, gee, what was it anyway? And where is the foundation, and what does a person fall back on?
Yeah, I just want to react. It's going to sound funny to talk about a pastor who saw what he did as work instead of vocation. He was a man who was very frustrated through two different parishes where he was the sole pastor, and since none of you know who I'm talking about, just did not have the gifts of administration or leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Had phenomenal interpersonal mm-hmm. relationships, mm-hmm. but as far as leadership and administration, very poor. And I think what he did is he saw in these two parishes it was a work. It was a job to be their pastor. And finally, the second congregation just closed, and he became an assistant pastor where his talents
mm-hmm.
were being used. He didn't have the burdens of administration, and now is so joyful in a vocation
mm-hmm.
rather than burdened with work.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, and sort of in response to the long-term and vocation and work, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that this does not, looking at vocation does not exclude working someplace for your whole working career. It's just saying that all the value of who you are and what you do, that might be the means of vocation, but it isn't the same as, and so that you're not so dependent upon the changes that go with that. Whether it's the loss of the job or even a change in the work that you do within
There's
that job.
There's never a challenge for that until you do lose your job. I mean, you don't know that until you lose your job.
Or if you work in a culture, in a particular job culture, digital versus IBM, and I've worked with both of them. I worked for digital, and then I've been at IBM as a client. IBM tends to foster sort of what I call the seduction to the work. I mean, it's there, and up until recently, people could depend on it. At digital, your job often did go away. This culture was one that your job could go away at any point. So you had to really be thinking about what am I going to do next. you worked for the same company, but you often went through downsizing and lost your job, but you didn't lose your job from the company. I painted walls one summer because we weren't hiring and I was in personnel. So what I learned to do was paint walls, and I helped make disk drives. I got paid my salary, but I learned a lot about what it means to work with people who are hourly workers. I got very sensitized, but I painted walls most of that summer. So I had to think about, so what am I going to do next if I can't recruit people? So you're right, it can be both in the context of changing jobs a lot, but also in the context of if you're in a bigger company. What happens, though, in the crises you're talking about, is when this really does go away and you've never given much thought to what is your vocation. Because I say the word vocation to people, and they don't get it. They don't know what that means. We have to reclaim that word.
I think about money. You know, I mean, vocation is yeah, I mean, you could have a vocation, but it feels like you never have a grip on your finances or what you're going to do next or where you're going to go. Are you saying we should just get used to that then? That just becomes life and you just kind of live kind of like an itinerant?
No, I'm not suggesting that, but what I would be interested in what triggers in other people.
Well, I guess that was going to be my point too, because my life situation has, I'm having the luxury of being totally driven by that vocation. But in our culture, that is not valued, and it also has put me in a precarious financial situation. And so there's a lot of discomfort about that, even though when I write poetry or when I'm writing my journal, I can say, you know, and do Habitat for no pay and do other things for no pay. Mm-hmm. I can say, you know, I really am letting my faith and my values guide what decision I make and what I'm next going to do. But there's a real, that is predicated on having someone else providing income and debt. Mm-hmm. And so that's not, and then also there are issues within our culture of you do not, it isn't, if you say what you're doing, that you're a poet or you're a community volunteer, it really, especially if you've experienced before saying, well, I'm executive of a small nonprofit, you know, mm-hmm. and had a title, this is years, three and a half years of doing it now, and still not comfortable.
Mm-hmm. But see, that provides an opportunity for the church to respond to the way in which the culture sets it up. Because the culture does set it up. And there is what we call a value differential placed on title, job, etc. Now, the significance of the economy is that that is going away in a lot of cases. And in fact, the dismantling of the Fortune 500 is already happening. And what we're finding is that being dependent on a title or a certain kind of income, and certainly I'm not suggesting that people become nomadic and itinerant, but what I am suggesting is that those rules are changing and the economy is driving a kind of fluidity that will really unseat folks who have, what I said, drank the Kool-Aid. They did what they were supposed to do. They've gone to school, and they become an engineer, and they make so much money, and they have a kind of house. And then Chevron shows up and says, we're out of here. Thank you for sharing. It's been wonderful. Now, this is what I experience happening a lot with Generation X or 20-somethings who have seen what happens to people who drink the Kool-Aid. Anyone want to comment on that?
I attended college three, 4 years ago, and one of my close friends in college is working for Microsoft. And we were chatting about the milieu at Microsoft. She said, well, the boss works at least a 16-hour day. And the woman he married in a highly publicized marriage also worked 16 or 18 hour days. And it's pretty hard to survive in that company and maintain any sort of life outside of that company, doing less than the boss. And yet, Microsoft is one of the stars in telecommunications and electronics these days, an industry which also is seeing fewer and fewer because of automation. And I mean, it is sounding its own death knell in some ways. So the fact that it is one of the stars in the industry and is performing so beautifully, one cannot be a part of that team and sort of do less than boss or than one's peers. And as you find yourself at middle age with children and family, you know, the old story, truly caught in a bind. If you let it go, there may not be anything around the corner. And yet, to complete a career requires that you continue to perform at that level.
And the question is, what sort of life does that produce for you?
Sure.
Other than some economic spoils. That could go away at any moment.
And it's not just in large corporations, it's also in small firms. I have a competitor in Cleveland, a company that started 10 years ago and has just skyrocketed so that they have, I think, 40 employees now, and in my profession, that's a lot of people. It's a PR firm. And one of the things that they do on a weekly basis is they have a weekly meeting at the end of the day. I don't remember which day it is, but the end of the day, and they drag out a sheet to show who's worked so many hours, because it's a profession in which we bill by the hour. Every 15 minutes, you're charging somebody for something. And to keep your job there, you have to bill so many hours a week. And what they do is they drag out the sheet to show what time you signed in and what time you left and how many hours you billed. And the person who billed the most number of hours and the person who didn't, I'm keeping the company going. And that's part of that corporate culture. And that's a small organization. But I think for me, the way I would look at that and the way I look at it in my own firm is the work is there and there are requirements. To stay with this kind of business, you do have to bill a certain number of hours. On the other hand, the vocation is what you bring to that situation and how you deal with that corporate culture or any corporate culture, whether it's a small firm or a large firm, and what restrictions you place on allowing that organization to come into your life or to learn to deal with the problems that are in that organization. And then to be able to set up some boundaries. And there, where we talk about work and vocation, if there isn't a place to go to learn those kinds of things about setting boundaries and that you are not your work, you don't know how to fight is a strong word, maybe deal with or manage that part of your life, and it becomes very difficult. And I think it's difficult for the church too, because the church, from my perspective, doesn't have the experience to know what the problems are. As you said a couple minutes ago, there's an opportunity, but how? Because people who are leaders in the church, although we have a lot of people who are second career pastors and church leaders, many times haven't had that corporate experience. And it's not that there's no desire or anything else, it's just you have to have some insight, you have to have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been there, you can see it in other places, but mm-hmm. if you haven't been there, you don't see it the same way.
And the dismantling of, what I would call the shift in the structure of corporate America requires a different response from the worker. Now, some of that is driven by the convenience of so what we may call some multiple kinds of relationships that you can have with an organization. In my work, for example, I do contracts with organizations, so I set it up so that I negotiate, and I'm willing to say I will do this and I won't do that. I'm very, very careful about the work I do around diversity because my standard has to fit with what's coming out of what I sense is my vocation, which is driven from my faith. And there's some things I simply won't do. It probably means for me a difference between whether or not Katie goes to a private school or she goes to public school. And I made the decision last year she goes to public school because I can't afford it now because of the choices I'm making. Does that make me a better or less of a father? I don't think so. Because at the same time, I made other commitments which freed me up to do more things with her rather than zipping off to Chevron to help them cut yet another 3,000 people out of X. I'm out of the cutting business. Now, you raise an issue around fair wage and those kinds of things, which I think the church seems silent on that issue. We are shifting in terms of the kinds of work that's available. Some of it's a work out of hospitality. It's a work around service. It's work around taking care of people. But that kind of work isn't valued. When I think about what we pay child care providers, and what we pay someone sitting in a room sort of figuring out how to come out with the next sort of computer-based toy, there's something extremely questionable about that. So I know that our current ELC is working on a statement around economics, but that's something the church could really press on. It's being able to work for a living wage.
Yes. We also are doing the statement on economics, and I think it's really interesting that pastors that are sitting on this committee are being paid different wage scale too. We
yes.
have some pastors that are working full time, pressing themselves into serving as full time pastors in smaller congregations that may be earning $15,000-$20,000 less than somebody else, which also affects their pension.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a unilateral guide mm-hmm. for that. So a person who's dedicated themselves to maybe a different type of ministry may come out and can barely live.
Because they've decided to be a campus pastor.
Yeah.
They feel called to that.
A smaller rural congregation mm-hmm. that just doesn't have as much money.
Or an inner city mission congregation.
Sure.
Too. Yeah, you're right. And so what's our statement of stewardship?
Well, it's strange to me, for lack of a better word, that they're thinking of this thing of economics, yet I think within our own church and the way that we pay some of its paid workers, and particularly the clergy roster, which mm-hmm. I'm a member, so
sure.
it starts in the rag and bone. I have friends that are going through. I think it's something that we have to look at too as a church and how we compensate our clergy.
Exactly.
Should there be, if you're in 10 years across the board, whether you serve a congregation of 200 or 1,000?
Well, I call it, again, it's the more robust standard that says, what are our standards?
Yeah, what are the standards?
Mm-hmm. And also it has to do with what I call stewardship of your assets as an organization or a church.
Good.
And so that we're not sort of perpetuating this sort of denial about those realities. Yes, and I'd like to hear from some people that I haven't heard from.
I think the church is going through a downsizing just like everything else in society.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't named it yet, I don't think. But you know, I've been unemployed or underemployed for 2 years. And when you're in that position, you meet other people in that position. And there are tons of people, tons of pastors who are underemployed or unemployed or have had to give up the vocation of ministry and do other types of work. I mean, you mentioned early, you know, that we're still functioning on the 1950s model of the church, and we just can't sustain it in the 90s. Economically, we can't sustain it in the 90s, and I think there's a tremendous downsizing going on in the church. I've yet to hear anyone name it, though, and call it that, but it's surely going.
If not downsizing, there certainly is a recalibration. And as it affects people on the clergy rosters, the question I'd have to ask as a person who thinks about human resources is the contract. See, you signed up for, in many ways, you drank the Kool-Aid around a lifelong contract. And that's, even at best, is probably questionable of a lifelong full-time contract. And are we, by not naming it and dealing with it, somehow perpetuating a sort of a false contract? Because in many ways, the pastors that I know who are successful have figured out that they really kind of have to do something between the tradition of a vocation of being called and a work of priest. And I know a number of people who are teaching on the side, counseling on the side, but they're generating income and still fulfilling a piece of their call, or people are taking part-time calls and sustaining themselves with using their gifts in other venues. I think the whole question of what is ministry, really, we kind of get back to that. What does this have to say about our role as a church in terms of preparing young people for living out their faith in the world?
You know, I just read this great book by Jeremy Rifkin. One of the things he says is that the downside is that we're seeing the destruction of the Fortune 500 and an inevitable loss of the market economy as we've known it. But the upside is that, he hypothesizes, and I think I'd have to agree, is that there's a tremendous opportunity, certainly for the church, but for a number of others, and in that what we'll see is a contraction of the business, of the market, capitalism as we've known it, of government as we've known it, but inevitably, as fewer people are employed full-time, perhaps many, many more people will be employed part-time. It opens up tremendous opportunity for personal growth and for growth of what he calls the third sector, which is, you know, the sector of volunteerism, the sector of personal growth, of community, and certainly the church is a big part of that. And I anticipate that its role will expand markedly, and there'll be wonderful opportunities in the future for the growth of our civilization, which in fact may have seen some diminution in the last several decades.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think if we can begin to deal with this challenge, this economic challenge around pay and value of work, which are really, I think, two critical things, and I think the economy may drive us there. I'm not so sure what I call the diminishing of financial well-being of certainly middle-class folks is going to be sustained. I think that the country's going to have a difficult time allowing that to continue. And I think we may be reaching a point where enough people have downsized because of all of the downsizing that's going on. They've had to downsize their lives. That question has to get on the table. And if we don't solve that one, then we really will have difficulty moving, I think, to a sort of a vocation-driven culture.
Have you seen any rumblings of middle-class people really questioning the American dream, though? Because I've been amazed in working as a social worker at the strength within totally marginalized people of somehow believing in that American dream,
mm-hmm.
no matter where they are, whether they're homeless, whether they're totally outside the structure, they still see themselves as other than the people that have failed, and still see the American dream out there of all the stuff
mm-hmm.
as being somehow attainable. I'm thinking, for the last 10 years, this is one of those things that mm-hmm. has bothered me, mm-hmm. that I think that it's so strong.
Mm-hmm.
And people who have been totally hurt by this will still somehow hold on to it as something that's going to be just around the corner.
Some of the signals, and it'd be interesting to hear what other people will see, that I experience in the culture is denial and anger, which is part of the death process of a mental model, and the mental model being the American dream. I don't think the American dream is going away. I just think the mental model around it is shifting. So I see the first phases of that process, which is an enormous amount of dissatisfaction and dislocation and fear, exemplified in some fairly aberrant kinds of behavior in our culture. I'm fascinated with Timothy McVeigh and have a tremendous amount of compassion. And I have compassion for the victims, but I'm intrigued by what drives that young man. I don't know all of the details, but apparently he wanted to become some part of a special forces in the Army, had really thought about drinking the Kool-Aid and joining the Army, and had this tremendous disappointment of not being able to get in the special forces, and the tremendous amount of need to scapegoat. And what's going on in our culture now is an enormous amount of scapegoating. It's a horrible place to be, but I think it's part of what I see. If I step back from it, I really do see it as a process of people finally beginning to give it up, question. The hopelessness that we see in the inner cities, in some cases, I think of rap music and gangster rap as just a kind of refuting of the delicacies of the culture. I'm disturbed by it, but to me, I see it as a process of untangling the nightmare, actually, for some people, of the American dream. I would say on the American dream, there's a positive part of it, but it's also a nightmare. And so those are some of the signals I see as denial and finally beginning to say, this is not right. And I'm not saying the behavior is okay. What I am saying is that they, for me, represent signals. Yes?
One other dimension to this, I think of what I was even talking, is the whole issue with men and women in the workplace. You know, working toward a goal of having equal pay for equal work. And I think that traditionally, you know, one of my memoirs we're in the workplace. I did the work, but we're in the workplace. They didn't have a sense of their vocation. Whereas women, I think, had a sense of their vocation, but weren't in the workplace. And now we've got women in the workplace wanting to be in the workplace with men. But I think that their sense of vocation is still making it very difficult for them. Because, you know, a lot of them want to be mothers. A lot of them want to, you know, do the other things they want to be as women. Aside from the workplace, what happens to them is they have to wind up doing both.
Or they decide to shift. I mean, one of the things that's happened, again, around talent management, which is why do so many women with all of their credentials, the MBAs, et cetera, from Harvard, Princeton, you name it, the first phase of women, a number of them have gone on and they've just left because there's no sense of connection to their vocation. Yes, they can go create the Wheaties campaign just like any other guy can. But you know, once you've done one of those, two of those things, it really leaves you empty. You go, you know, sort of, what do you do? Well, I kind of figure out, will we put Magic Johnson on the Wheaties box or not? That's sort of what I do. Now, that could be an interesting project in life, but when kids show up and other things show up that are more important to you, you begin to balance those out. You know, I loved it to be able to tell people, well, I really work with Haagen-Dazs. Well, that usually evoked very positive things in people's minds, and I could tell them about what peanut butter flavors will do for you. But does it really help people who sort of need to sort of be fed and reminded there's such a thing as faith? No, not really. It did give me a way for me to sort of be able to be freed up to go do that. So I think that women in the workplace, what I'm seeing, at least at the executive levels, is people saying, I'm out of here. Some of the great talent in the country is not in the Fortune 500. In fact, you've got many ways to be in the C-team playing.
I did the same thing. I think it's going to be a disenchantment with women who can park on the workplace.
Yes, because you have to give up so much of yourself.
Yeah.
in order to drink the Kool-Aid. Again, I have to ask myself the question, and this is where healing comes in, is there's a great opportunity for healing in our society because there's a numbness kind of happens when you work in that sort of environment. And it's amazing to see people 2 and 3 years after they've been downsized and they figured out that carpentry sort of works. Or they've realized that, you know, having the 4,000 square foot house in Edina isn't necessarily what they need, and it doesn't necessarily bring happiness. I just did that. I just sold my, you know, moved on. And I have to tell you, some of the saddest people I know are millionaires. And some of the saddest people and overworked people I know are people that make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. We've got to, I think, begin to think about that your bank account and the money is not the totality of your life. And yes, you need to have a home and all of those things, and I think those things are deserved. But I also think that at the end of your life, most people don't stand up at a funeral and say, well, I really miss Joe because Joe made $200,000 a year. People miss you because of your witness. And so the balance or the challenge is, where do you have your faith show up in the design of what you do? And I still believe that you can do that and be successful.
But it's a merit-based culture.
Exactly.
So if you don't think and reflect about this, mm-hmm. if it just sort of happens around you, and
yeah.
you're not connected to a community that reminds you that you're not part of a merit-based culture, and you're young, and you're just starting out, and you're trying to figure out how to do this life,
mm-hmm.
and you get spun into the merit-based culture, and you grow with that, all of a sudden you begin to see that, well, the way I'm going to show that I'm good, let's not define good for the moment, the way I show I'm good mm-hmm. is to have a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And so then you go after all of those things because you want to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point you find out that you didn't define good, and uh-oh.
Which again, and I agree with you, is which is part of the issue. Is like we graduate thousands of people from our colleges, and I meet them, and they've done no thinking about vocation, their faith, and life planning, what's important. Some people say, well, I want to live simply. I'll go, well, why? And what does that mean? And how does that fit with your faith? It's not a fad. And the other thing is, maybe you do want to go work for IBM. You could learn a lot there. But life is a series of projects, and your work is not the total sum of who you are.
One of the things that I've been thinking about with this, I'm on a bank board, and downsizing's happened
yeah.
Thursday. And so I was talking to some of the executives about, I just read Walking on Water by Madeline Lingle, and she mm-hmm. talks about your work should be your love.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is happening with this culture is there can be people that are in something they love.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd say it's vocation. But with downsizing, if you love doing something 8 hours a day, you may not love doing it 16 hours a day. So
mm-hmm.
what's happening in our society can end up, you get your love killed.
Exactly.
By the rate at which you are having to do it.
Or the expectations that are yeah. being designed. Basically, the work hasn't gone away.
The vocation, the love of what you do,
does.
Can be totally destroyed.
You're right.
By the way you're having to do it now under the new rules of fewer people doing the same amount of
yes.
job. And I don't know how that gets changed until the whole society changes from that. I mean, I think we're going through a tremendous change.
What's happening is, talent, at least in, and I would say this in some of the professional levels, in corporations, because 3M is a client, they're finding that people who have sort of figured this out are only going to, the boundary question, are going to say, hey, I'm available, and here's how much you can pay me, and after that, I'm not available. It's like 3M called me and said, could you rush back from Holden Village? Could we fly you in for 2 days back to Minneapolis to help us with this meeting? I said, and it's a project that was like 50 days of work this year. Could have probably made my, and I said, no, if I have to leave Holden Village because that's what is important for me to do right now. I can't do your project for you. I'll consult to you. I'll do everything before I leave. But if I have to come back here, I can't do that for you. Guess what happened? I thought, well, I'd lost the project. You know, well, so, great, some other consultant will have it. The day before I came here, I got a voicemail. Anthony, hi, we want you to do the project. We'll see you in July. So more and more people are beginning to say, not in a negative way. It's like, this is my boundary. I can't do this for you. I've got commitments. And you make decision however you want to make it. And they're beginning to find that the more people do that, it's amazing what the system will do in response to you. I want to speak for a couple minutes before, were there other comments before I move on?
Are you going to address interim management companies that are starting up? Just to introduce that concept.
No, go ahead. Why don't you talk about that?
You know, when you go out and hire yourself out to a temporary agency, there are companies that are starting up now, and the concept started in Australia and Germany, and it's come here. There are companies who, if you are an executive or a manager, you can go there and you can take a temporary executive level position, depending on your field, whether or not they place in that area, and you can get these 3-month, 9-month assignments. So if you've been outplaced and can't get work, or if you just find that you need to be able to set boundaries, as you said, mm-hmm. that there are ways that can be done now. So because you can make money at it, I'm sure that's why these companies are starting up, but also it's an avenue that if you don't know about it, you can share it with other people. It exists now, and it's a new thing. It started in Cleveland just 6 years ago, mm-hmm. so it's a new thing, and just keep your eyes open for it, because I think it could be a good response as just one method to deal with this problem.
I have the state of Minnesota approach me. They don't have a lot of money to pay the rates that I would charge, but they said, we would like to hire you on a very small part-time basis, and what we can offer is health care, and we can offer a pension opportunity to you just because if you would give us so many hours a month. Now, I've told them I needed to think about that, but the trade-off for me is, boy, I get my health care covered, which I'm paying $600 a month for a family because you're an independent contractor. It's exorbitant, but so I'm going to do a project with them because of the health care coverage. So there's all those kinds of ways in which you can work things out. Granted, it's at an infant's kind of stage, but it is a trend. I have a couple more things to say before we close out, and I want to make sure that I give everybody an opportunity to comment against this framework for discussion. Somehow, with all of this struggle and frothing and changing and evolution, I think that, again, as I said over here, you've got to kind of go back to your faith. I think that your faith really provides you with grounding, like we had in our earlier discussion, that you got to have one foot grounded in your faith. And so I thought about that a little bit. And these, again, I'm throwing these out for possible discussion. One is that in many ways we need to go back to the stable. I had this experience when I visited Bethlehem and reclaim Advent and the great work. I think we're always in the process of birthing and to reclaim what that means for us and to think about what is the great work, and in our language we might call that the Great Commission. And what might that mean as a citizen, a teacher, doctor, preacher, pastor? What does that mean to sort of reclaim that or rebirth your vocation? The second one has to do with reformation for our community. I think we're yearning at the end of the millennium for another reformation. Maybe that's language is too old. I don't know. I know we're talking about language here at Holden, but some person said, well, Anthony, do you really mean transformation? I said, yeah, transformation with sort of a good stiff kick. I always like rereading Luther or reclaiming Luther and I often wonder what would, if we had sort of Luther here today, what would be his choice of technology? What words might he use? Would he really use the MF word to get people's attention? I don't know, but it'd be interesting to think that through, because Luther was always, I think, at the edge, calling it and providing an opportunity for confession, and again, rooted in faith. So how does it, what does it mean to live out a fellowship with Jesus through the power of the gospel with one another? And I think that there's an opportunity for some new dialogue about what that means for us now in 1995. And then love and being confessional about it. And it has to be vital and alive and dynamic and expressive. And this is why I think when we sit in our Lutheran churches sometimes, and I'm talking about the Lutheran context, and we lament these mega churches or these non-denominational churches, and oftentimes when I think about it, there's a vitality that attracts people. But sometimes it's a vitality without any substance. And if I'm, as a marketing person, I think the culture is crying out for what I think Lutheranism provides. From in terms of our theology and our orthodoxy and our history, and we need to reclaim that and talk about it. And with that, I'll just sort of leave it open to some final comments from people, and we'll move on. Thoughts based on what I've laid out for you.
You talked about some people wanting to sell God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about, I teach part-time at Bopper's University, and there's been kind of a changing, trying to more react to the upcoming student environment. And when I think about Lutheranism there, chapel is not required, it's optional, and but the biggest portions of their spiritual life that those students attend to is that which is vital, alive and dynamic, where that's, you don't see great numbers of people coming to Sunday worship because it doesn't feel, in the consumer age that we're in, vital, alive and dynamic. And I think that at that particular place, we're just struggling with mm-hmm. how do you respond. You know, there are definitely places that like students go to worship and find meaning and can learn about vocation and how you create a community. But I think it's also struggling with how do you balance what has been with what we don't know yet.
Yeah, that's very true. The other thing, the other piece that triggers, at least for me as I dialogue with you, is the good news is that people are seeking. The bad news is that we're not the choice. and I think we have to look at that, at the reality of that. And I also believe that we have an excellent, we have something to say and something that's very vital. And oftentimes when we're in these dialogue sessions over dinner with people about, the people go, gee, why don't we just stand up and say who we are? Some people in ELCA say we have an identity crisis. I say, no, you have a communication problem. Your identity's there. The issue is how do you publicly state where you're coming from? And people are yearning for some grounded response to the craziness. Other last comments before, yes?
That's why people come here, Anthony. I think that Holden Village provides people an opportunity to kind of reground themselves in their vocation. It's a safe place to have communication.
Mm-hmm.
And, what you do with your work is pretty much immaterial. Your heard, your credibility has nothing to do with your work. Nobody cares what your work is.
That's right. That's right. And it's an opportunity to engage in dialogue so that you may have a new perspective on something. Final comments before we close out.
But this is already in the church. Mm-hmm. Preaching to the converted here.
Although through the years, there's a lot of people who come here that are on the search.
Well, sure. But in the overall scheme of things, perhaps today the message is more important than the process is more important than the end product.
Or the process influences the end product. You've got the product, it's the packaging and the process or the service. Wouldn't it be interesting to do career development starting with your catechism and grounding in your faith? Wouldn't that be an interesting process to go through? Clearly being what I call grounded in reality around the economic conditions, but wouldn't that be interesting for the church to provide that kind of guidance for people?
We have baptismal sponsors. Do we have catechism sponsors?
Yeah.
And if we do in our church, and then how are they involved? Would that be a way?
Yeah, so do we have, or do we reclaim our catechism? As we do that yearly, we have to seek out a sponsor and a mentor that we study with over the year on a particular issue.
Okay.